Station number 8939, Captain Ian Hamilton, Reel 12.
Where did you go after the fighting at Breskens?
Well, I think I mentioned that we were put on transporters and we came through the tunnel under the Scheldt to Antwerp, and we went to a Napoleonic fort, Fort Schoten, which was a strange place. We felt secure there because of the V2 bombs that were dropping continuously on Antwerp with terrible damage. We did go into Antwerp a couple of times, but we thought it was safer not to. We weren't there for very long, a few days, perhaps a week or two, and then we moved on into to Holland, near Tilburg, to the village of Diessen, in the case of my squadron. Other squadrons were in nearby villages, Hilvarenbeek, I think. Once again, I myself was billeted with the Pastor, which turned out to be a very happy billet. A rather austere man, but very friendly. And he kept himself more or less to himself, but was happy to talk. We conversed in French. He didn't have any English. And in the evenings, I'd usually go to the kitchen, which was the warmest place, and his housekeeper, Jo, and his niece, Gerada, and I didn't speak Dutch, and they didn't speak English, but we did all sorts of things, and I taught them all sorts of English songs, like My Bonnie is Over the Ocean, and so on. And in fact, I've kept up correspondence with Jo, and have met her several times. I discovered only fairly recently that she had been widowed in the first week of the war. She'd married a Dutch soldier, and he was killed in the first week. And she'd never remarried. She'd remained the housekeeper to the Pastor. And we've kept up a tremendously friendly correspondence ever since.
Was he a Protestant pastor?
No, he was a Catholic pastor. And I remember one of his visitors was a Cistercian monk. I cannot remember his name, but a marvellous man to talk to. Spoke a number of different languages and a very learned person, tremendous to talk to. So different to the things that were going on around at the time. We had a rather marvellous experience. I think it was from Diessen. We had a number of marvellous experiences. We had a number of trips into Brussels as a leave centre. And it was on one of those when a brother officer asked me if I would bring back some Chanel No. 5 for his girlfriend, and gave me the cash. I went in on the lorry, on the three tonner. It was a hairy journey because it was in the winter, snow, ice on the roads, very heavy camber on some of the roads, and I can remember seeing a string of three tonners all going towards Brussels, sliding off the road in all directions. Anyway, we got in there, and we went first to the somewhere to park, and I bought a large bottle of Chanel No. 5, quite a large bottle, and put it in my greatcoat pocket. And then we went on to the Stella Artois brewery to buy a barrel of the good stuff for the lad's Christmas. And I jumped out of the lorry, and there was a donking sound, and my pocket hit the cobbles, and I felt something wet and cold trickling down my leg. You can guess what it was. Thereafter, whenever I went into a shop, the entire clientele and the assistants sort of stopped what they were doing, sniffed the air, and said, "Oh, Monsieur, sans bien." And I did sans bien for years. I had that greatcoat cleaned several times and it still kept that smell. Of course, I had to buy another bottle for my friend, which is quite an expensive business. I went into Brussels several times for various jaunts. We were able to have a 48-hour leave, for instance, which was interesting. In the Atalanta Hotel, I went twice, I remember. Met some very charming hostesses there. One of whom invited me to her home, which was obviously a very rich family in Brussels, but received me. It was interesting to compare the opulence of their house with the rather meagre fare they were able to offer, because although Brussels and Belgium generally was pretty well off as far as food was concerned, it was a great deal less than they were accustomed to, obviously. Anyway, they're all very charming people. I can remember going to the cinema in Brussels and seeing Errol Flynn in Robin Hood, which was fascinating. Anyway, it's nothing to do with the war, really. I remember that I was away from the squadron for a time. I cannot remember why, but when I returned, they'd moved to another village, a village of Kasteren, which was a little closer to Eindhoven. Again, I was bunged in with the pastor. This one was a different kettle of fish. He was not very keen, not very welcoming at all. And it's the coldest room I think I've ever slept in. I had my camp bed there. But the people of Kasteren were very, 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 very nice indeed. And my troop were in some what would amount to council houses in billets, because this was the depths of winter. And whenever I went on a billet inspection, which we did practically every day, I was welcomed with open arms, and we were all sitting round the kettle, as they called it, the fire, which was glowing red hot up the chimney. And they didn't have anything much to offer us, but we used to give them a lot of our rations. And they were very, very nice people.
Why do you think the pastor was so unwelcoming?
I think he was more pro-German than pro-British. That's my conclusion. But I had very little to do with him, indeed, and nor with his housekeeper.
Had you come across any other evidence of pro-German feeling in Holland
no,
or Belgium on the way
no,
out?
No, quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. Back in the little village of Semmerzeck near Ghent, where we came before the Breskens do, we were told we were going to be there 3 weeks. We were to change our tracks, because you remember we'd come on our tracks all the way across France. But in fact, we were halfway through changing the tracks when we got the order to move for the Breskens do, and had to either put the old tracks on or hurriedly get the new tracks on. But the people there were very, very hospitable. Again, I was with a pastor who used to produce pears from his pear tree, insisted on cutting each pear into quarters to see if it was suitable to offer me to eat. His sister, with whom who was his housekeeper, was as deaf as a post, and he had a little dog called Milor, and Milor would react if the pastor said, "Where are the Moffe, the Germans?" He would bark his head off. And if he said, "Where are the British?" then the little dog would lie on his back with his paws in the air, and then he'd say, "Up!" And he'd go rushing around, and very friendly. He'd been taught, obviously, very well to do these things. And I got very friendly with the burgomaster there and his family, and I've kept up a certain correspondence with them and visited them. However, to get back to Kasteren, we spent Christmas there, and the cooks surpassed themselves. I'm talking with the squadron cooks, made a superb Christmas dinner. I think I've got the menu somewhere. And we had this beer that we'd brought up, and I'd been saving up my spirit ration, because I didn't drink whiskey or gin. I'd been saving that up, and so had my sergeant, and we pulled that. We had a big ammunition box with all the bottles we'd collected, all sorts of things. And after the Christmas dinner, that evening, I had my troop in the schoolroom, which was the squadron mess, and we attacked the box. They brought their tin mugs with them, and I've never drunk champagne out of a tin mug before. Within 5 minutes, the whole lot had gone, vanished. And I'm a regret to say that First Troop was not on parade the next morning. One of them spent the night lying in the ditch outside, because we came out of the schoolroom into the cold, cold night, and the effect was startling. However, we were let off. Then there was the Ardennes business. I think we were stood two, if I remember rightly, but we couldn't move the tanks very easily. They'd frozen to the ground. It really was cold that Christmas, very cold indeed. I guess we could have got them going if we'd needed to, but in fact we were not called upon.
How well did you manage to follow wider developments?
We had the newspapers, and I think we got it mostly from the newspapers, and from time to time, when something rather special had happened, we were given a briefing.
You weren't involved in Operation Market Garden at all?
No. That's later on, isn't it? That's a bit later on.
It was in September.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Of course it was. No, we weren't. No, because we were coming across France at that time. One thing I do remember about this stay at Castron, we had an officers' dinner, I think at Hogalone, another little village, which was very nice. First time I'd ever eaten oysters. I don't know where they came from. But Sidney Hine, who was our adjutant or squadron commander of headquarters squadron at that time, I think, is a member of the Hine Brandy firm. He had contacts everywhere, and that was very useful. But also the Halle Orchestra came to Eindhoven, to Philips factory, to their big concert hall, and every soldier who could be spared went in, and the place was packed with troops. And it's one of the most marvellous experiences, concert experiences of my life. Sir John Barbirolli conducted, and they started with the Thieving Magpie Overture. And he made that orchestra play so quietly, it was incredible. You could hear the guns rumbling, even from, because they weren't very far away from Eindhoven, in fact, 6, 7, 8 miles, and an occasional shell would come over. But it was a fantastic experience. And a few weeks later, I was in Brussels on another one of these jaunts, and I met some of the orchestra in the lift in the hotel, and I told them how much we'd all enjoyed it. Chaps who'd never think of going to a symphony concert, how much they'd enjoyed it. And they were very pleased to know, and they said it had been a tremendous experience for them as well. Sir John Barbirolli mentions it in his autobiography. However, from there, where did we go from there? Well, I think, if my memory serves me correctly, we went in the direction of Venlo, but first of all, we went through a place called Nedervaert, and we were going to support some sort of attack that was going along. It was one of these continuous things that was going on. And even while we were waiting, we were on call, I remember, and there was an army cinema unit came to the It's either the nunnery or the or a monastery or some such religious place, and we were taken up into the attic. It was a long attic with an apex roof. And I can remember seeing Bing Crosby in Going My Way there. Anyway, we saw this film, and then we went supporting various troops along the canals there. It was not a very pleasant time. It was very wet. We always seem to be having wet. But it was along there, near Wert, that we first received our tank suits, the new army waterproof overall for tank crews. Initially we had enough for one per tank, but they came through in the course of a week or fortnight or something, enough for pretty well everybody, I think. But that was where we first got them. There was a little village hamlet called Panningen. And I can remember driving through there. I turned round in my turret to make sure that the tank behind me was following, and I got a terrific clout over the ear from a signal cable that was trailing across the road. It knocked my helmet and my earphones off into the road, and of course I couldn't get the driver to stop because I'd lost my microphone. I did recover them in the end, but I had a sore head for a long time after that. That was not very nice. We went into a brick kiln in Panningen, and I think we decided the safest place to sleep, to save us digging trenches, because it was so waterlogged there, it wasn't much use digging trenches anyway, was to sleep inside the brick kilns themselves. And I think it's the most uncomfortable bed and night's sleep that I've ever had. We took part then in the attack on Venlo, Blerick and Venlo, and there we met more mines in those few days than we'd met in the whole campaign. Every track was mined with just half a dozen telemines. Usually there were mines, telemines or anti-personnel wooden mines at every corner of every wood, every copse, every line of trees. It was incredible. The civilians fleeing from Venlo were caught a terrible lot of casualties. Children and women went up on mines, most of them killed, some of them very badly wounded. During the attack, we flailed through a proper belt of mines. We went on, and in the course of the action, every one of my tanks was knocked out temporarily. My own tank caught a mine. We'd been flailing, but obviously we'd blown a chain off, and it broke a track, but it didn't break completely. It only broke one side of the track, and we were able to carry on until we started to turn at one point, and then the track broke. It was more or less level with a track which went back to one of the roads which we wanted flailed and proved. We call it proving. And the remaining tank I had, my Sergeant McGuffey, my second sergeant, I stood outside my tank with the headset, and I guided him down this track to the road, and it all went well until he got within a few yards of the road, and there was an almighty explosion which blew me over. And I just got up in time to see his tank toppling into an enormous crater, where it remained still for a few moments. And we anxiously watched and started to run forward. And eventually one of the turret flaps flopped open, and then the other one, and a rather dazed head appeared. They were all okay inside, but had very bad headaches, but it had blown the jib completely off. Apparently it was a series of mines connected together, and it made an enormous impact.
When you were advancing down towards Venlo, you say it wasn't very pleasant because it was wet. Were the enemy opposing the advance strongly in that area?
I wouldn't have said strongly. There was opposition, but it was all rear guard action, as far as we were concerned anyway. We supported the infantry and tried to deal with as many of these mines as we could. We had to keep on stopping to replace chains. One of my troop went through a bit of field that was so boggy that it bellied down and it touched off a mine under the engine compartment. That put it out of action, of course, for quite a time.
What about at Venlo itself? Did the enemy have the minefields covered by anti-tank weapons?
I can't tell you, because we never actually got as far as that. There were considerable wire and mine defences. I think I've got an aerial photograph which shows a big anti-tank ditch, and I've got another photograph from the War Museum which shows a flail striking mines as it's going through wire. I honestly don't know what was happening. When I finally got my tank repaired later on that night, we were ordered to pull back, ready to be called forward in daylight. And we came back through the gap in the belt of mines that we'd flogged before. And sorry, that was not my tank. I hopped over onto the remaining tank of the five, left mine being repaired. And I rode on the gun to guide the driver in the darkness. And we got to this mine belt, and as we got to it, a jeep was coming through in the opposite direction, and it touched off what I think must have been an anti-personnel mine, which had was still there. And it blew up. The crew of the jeep were unhurt but shaken, and we got out to push the thing out of the way. We couldn't push it all together, so as there wasn't much clearance, we tried to get alongside, and I decided discretion was the better part of valour, and instead of sitting on the gun, I went round the back of the turret and controlled the driver from there. And as we went round the near side, left-hand track, touched a mine, and it broke the track, so we were stuck. That was the fifth tank. That was my lot out of action.
And all out due to mines, rather than
all due to mines. All due to mines. An interesting thing. Next morning, the infantry for the follow-up attack were coming through, and I wasn't there at the time. I was trying to deal with the recovery of the other vehicles, but the crew were still with that tank. And as the infantry marched by, I suppose a complete battalion went through, and then another lot came along and stopped alongside the tank on the path that had been trodden. And the silly sort of argument that often occurred between infantry and tank crews, you know, the infantry said, how you can sit in one of those big boxes open, you know, in full view of everybody. And I couldn't do that. And the tank crew would always say, how you can crawl around in the ground and sit in shell holes and be fired at, I can't imagine. And the argument got on to who had the best tea, infantry or tanks, and we said, it's an ordinary K pack or L pack or whatever it was. And the operator, Bob Burdett, climbed onto the tank, got out the tea thing to brew up some tea for the infantry and for themselves, jumped down onto the path and blew up, and he lost his foot. Now the whole battalion had passed along that path, and he happened to jump on that one place. Well, fortunately, there was an infantry aid post just a few yards away, and they came rushing out with a stretcher, plonked him on it, popped him on a jeep, went back to the base hospital, and he was back in England that afternoon. And he had his foot off, of course, and fitted with an artificial limb in due course. But that gives you an idea of how evacuation of casualties, how it could occur.
Was it the normal policy to send casualties back to England for treatment?
I think by that stage in the war it had become possible because of the use of airstrips in Belgium and Holland. Back in Normandy, to start with, of course, we had tented hospitals. There was one very close to us at Cresseron, between Cresseron and Douvres-la-Delivrande, big base hospital there, with nurses and doctors working under fire. But casualties were evacuated back to England as soon as possible, and if their circumstances warranted it. Major Oates, our squadron commander, who was filled full of anti-personnel shrapnel, was whipped back to England pretty well the next day, and that was very early on in sort of D plus 1 week or so.
What happened to you then after the fighting around Venlo?
Now that from here onwards, intervening events are rather sparse. But I seem to remember we were more or less held in reserve or on call at various locations. I believe regimental headquarters was at a place called Wurst, but I had no dealings with them at all. We were still working as a squadron or as troops. The next thing that we were involved with was the battle through the Siegfried Line. But before that happened, privilege leave was started back to England, 7 days, and I was fortunate enough, or unfortunate enough, to be sent on now that must have been while we were at Diesen. That's when I came back from leave to find the regiment, the squadron had moved to Castron. I think it must have been then. I know that I went on leave very